We're very happy to have Philip Phillips as our speaker today. I think many of you already know Philip, but for completeness, let me just say that he's a professor at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's contributed widely to many areas in condensed matter physics. I think one unifying aspect is that he's come up with very provocative ideas that have really challenged our conventional understanding. These include things like this random dimer model, which is the kind of a loophole to Anderson localization in 1D. He's worked on all sorts of other stuff like Bose metals, and recently ventured to the cutting edge of condensed matter in things like holographic correspondence, fractional electromagnetism, and all sorts of other very provocative ideas. So it's definitely a pleasure to have him join us today. And Philip, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, Tim. I've always enjoyed Tim, so it was a pleasure when he said, "Hey, could you give a talk?" I'm going to talk about a paper that came out recently in Nature Physics, and on some level, I feel embarrassed that we wrote this paper only this year. I think realistically, I should have written this paper 10 or 15 years ago, but it never occurred to me. And you'll see sort of why. We're able to put together superconductivity and Mottness and into exact results. My collaborators are a student, Luke Yeo, and a highly talented postdoc, Edwin Hwang. And this work came out in Nature Physics and has a news and views on it by Jan Zanon. So let's start with superconductivity. Superconductivity, vanishing of the resistivity, the first inkling of how this phenomenon might be explained is the Cooper instability, that two electrons with an attraction between them, G will always represent the attraction. These are the operators for pairs of electrons. They will condense into a bound state below the chemical potential. The fact that there's already a bunch of filled states here makes this observation, although interesting, highly problematic. And it tells you ultimately that the ground state is unstable to annihilating two electrons. So let me put the Cooper problem, BCS, and Fermi liquid theory all together because they form an integral unit. So we start with the Fermi surface and we scale towards the Fermi surface. So this kinetic term has scaling dimension zero. What you find is that if you add on repulsions, the repulsions just move the energy levels around if they're short range. There's still a one-to-one correspondence between every state here and the state here. And this means that the repulsions are irrelevant. In fact, it's obvious that they are irrelevant because they have scaling dimension one. And as a result, this is a tight story. The only instability of a Fermi surface is an attraction between electrons on opposite sides of the Fermi surface. And this is the pair interaction. And the key quantity which characterizes BCS is this ratio, 2 delta over KTC is 3.5. Okay, so we say then that superconductivity in Fermi liquids is a solved problem because we've isolated, the theory is natural, we've isolated the only possible instability, and hence it's a done deal. So you can start with a Fermi gas, and not much going on there. You have excitations in a Fermi liquid, quasiparticles, and you get these things to pair up and you form a BCS superconductor. And the question is there anything else? And what I want to suggest is that there is something else. Okay, so is there a physics beyond BCS? If there is, this requires a new fixed point beyond Fermi liquid theory. Okay, so the cuprates offer such a possibility because they start off their lives not as Fermi liquids, but rather as Mott insulators. And the key observation by Mott is that it costs an energy to move electrons around. And if this energy is sufficiently large, you can open a gap. And the key thing about a Mott insulator is that you do so without changing the size of the Brillouin zone. And that's incredibly important because it means this, the spectral wave here and here are in the same band. It's not as if these are different bands, as would be the case if you broke a symmetry. So this is a local real space problem. We conceive of the Mott problem as strong interactions within each cell, and somehow magically this gap opens. And one of the key points I want to make is that this is not the only way of getting a Mott insulator. And it's sort of surprising that there is a way, another way. So what do you do? Well, you have to go and solve the Hubbard model because that's the model that has Mottness in it. You have to go and demonstrate that you have a Cooper instability. And since you can't solve the Hubbard model except in one dimension, proving that there's a Cooper instability is even harder. And hence, it's safe to ask the question, what has been the progress thus far? Well, there are lots of numerics that have been done, and they have various acronyms. Let me just tell you about one famous dispute. Before I tell you about the dispute, let me get some water. Okay, so this dispute is between two incredibly famous people. One is Bob Laughlin, and the other is Phil Anderson. And Phil Anderson wrote the rejoinder to this critique of two metals. And Bob Laughlin is excoriating the field of solid state physics for even thinking about Mott insulating terminology. He says, nowhere can we find any of this stuff well-defined, and hence we should just forget about it and just think about semiconducting bands. Phil Anderson, on the other hand, says that, no, this is wrong. And he says that the statement that we can't figure out what Mott insulation is would be ludicrous if it were not so influential. And he ends by saying, it is a tragedy of Mott that although he most certainly won his Nobel Prize for the Mott insulator, Slater, who couldn't think clearly about finite temperature, won the publicity battle. Okay, so what is the nature of this debate? And it is central to my thinking about this problem. Okay, so what Laughlin's objection is that one is trying to generate a gap in a single band in which these and these are not in different bands. They're just states that evolved from here. But you see that if these states evolve from here, then you've broken the correspondence because each state is splintered into something above and below the chemical potential, which means you've gone from a 1 to 2 correspondence just by opening this charge gap without these being in different bands. Okay, and Laughlin's objection is that no one's demonstrated this. There's some numerics, but it's numerics. So, you have the sign problem, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so then what I decided to do is, if in fact there's this dispute between Laughlin and Anderson, there must be some way of settling it. So I asked the question, what's the difference between Phil Anderson and Bob Laughlin? And the difference is Mottness. And one can quantify what Mottness is by zeros. And these are zeros of the single particle Green function. Everything Laughlin is talking about, this quantity is non-zero. The intrinsic part of what was in Mott's head when he talked about Mott insulation, this quantity is certifiably zero. So let me tell you about zeros and how they come into this model we ended up solving. So if you want to count particles, it's very simple to count particles. You just put numbers on them and there they are. But is there a more efficient way of counting particles? There is a more efficient way, and this is the Luttinger counting theorem, which asks a very simple question. What happens if you just count every place where this function changes sign? And this function can only change sign in the vicinity of pole-like singularities. It's negative here and positive over here. And it's if you count the region that is positive, you will pick up every particle in the system. And assuming every k state has a weight 2 because of spin, this quantity, theta, the Heaviside step function, when this quantity is positive, you end up with a non-zero contribution, and hence you should count the number of particles in the system. Okay. But you can see something immediately. This Heaviside step function is non-zero anytime the argument is positive, but it doesn't discriminate how this function became positive. This function can be become positive by just crossing this real axis. And if it does so, this would be a zero crossing. Now, this function here can never be zero. So if in fact you're seeing a zero crossing, it's telling you your green function doesn't look like this. Okay, so what are zeros? Zeros are telling you about lack of propagation. So they're telling about the breakdown of the particle concept. And that is incredibly front and center to the whole Mott problem. And that's what I call Mottness. Okay, so how do zeros obtain? Let's look at the spectral function in the Mott problem. You have to assume it's possible to get this. Why would this give rise to zeros? So it gives rise to zeros because this is the imaginary part of the green function, if it looks like this. The real part can be constructed by a Kramers-Kronig from the Kramers-Kronig relationships. Just take this moment. This quantity is positive. This changes sign. So there is a part below and above the gap that have different signs. And if there's some part below that's negative, some part above that's positive, this can balance out and give you a zero. So zeros are telling you about the balancing of the spectral weight above and below the chemical potential. And since the green function is computed within a band, it's important that these are in the same band. Otherwise, the Luttinger sum rule wouldn't make any sense. It's just within a band. Okay, so then we have this quantity can be zero in this case. And so this is telling about strongly correlated gap systems. Now you can get zeros without a gap, and I will show you that in a minute. But this is the essence of zeros. Now, if you were to break a symmetry, in other words, a charge density wave or something like this, these would be in different bands. And your green function would look like this. The real part of the determinant here is just a product of these two things, neither of which can be zero. Hence, the product can never equal zero. And hence, the statement symmetry breaking can never give rise to zeros. And hence, focusing on whether or not this quantity is equal to zero is the correct quantity, is the thing which will tell you if you have Mott physics or you don't. Okay, now are zeros important? I've certainly shown that they can come about in the Mott problem, but what role do they really play in strongly correlated physics? Okay. One of the experimental findings over the years in HITC is that the spectral function consists of a bunch of arcs. So these are quasi-particle excitations which don't extend all the way to the Brillouin zone edge. So across an arc, the green function changes sign. The real part changes sign. So consider a path from here to here that encounters the arc, but comes back around this point that doesn't experience the arc. You have to change the sign of the green function. But how can you maintain the sign when there's nothing here that tells you you have to change the sign? Since you can't appeal to pole-like excitations to change the sign, your only resort is zeros. So if in fact you're seeing arcs, you have to have a set of zeros here, or you have to have a backside of the arc, in which case you'll go from negative to positive back to negative, and as there's no problem coming back around here. So either arcs don't exist, or if they do exist, there have to be zeros. So let's assume that arcs exist, then in fact, zeros have to be present. Okay, now what I started with is a Fermi surface, and I showed that there's nothing that you can add of the repulsive nature to give rise to any of this Mott physics, which is roughly sort of another way of thinking about Laughlin's argument. So what went wrong? Well, you should go and solve the Hubbard model. But if you solve the Hubbard, you can't solve the Hubbard model in 2D. And hence, you have to go and do something more imaginative if you want to make any definitive statement about Mott physics. Now, this physics is all in real space. What if you don't go and do this, but rather you think about Mott insulation in momentum space? Now you might think, well, this is just crazy. And even for me, this is actually crazy, but I realize that it's right. And so let me just review some of this. There's someone at Perimeter who had similar ideas a very long time ago. In fact, everyone who had ideas about this had them a long time ago. It's just that no one took them seriously. Okay, so what I want to do is focus on the Hatsugai-Komoto model, written down in 1992, a year before Sachdev Yee wrote their paper. And Bhaskaran did his work, which is roughly similar to this Hatsugai-Komoto model. So it's the standard nearest neighbor kinetic energy giving rise to well-defined band dispersion. But it has another piece, and it's not the Hubbard interaction. It's an all-to-all interaction. And the thing that you preserve when you have this all-to-all interaction is the center of mass. And this is weighted by 1/1 the volume, because this term needs to have a correction so that it scales extensively. Okay, now I don't know if Hatsugai and Komoto were doing this by reverse engineering, but let's assume they were, because they're very smart people. And what they must have known is that if you take this model and you Fourier transform it, you end up with an ultra solvable model. You end up with a model in which this term, since it's completely non-local in, or anti-local rather, in real space, it's completely local in momentum space. And if it's local in momentum space, this commutes with this term, the model is completely solvable. Now you would think that any model in which this and this term commute, that, you know, you wouldn't have anything non-trivial. The model has non-trivial physics, it turns out. Now, this describes the Fermi liquid part of the problem. So now I have an interaction in momentum space, so I can ask the Polchinski question, is this relevant? This is a relevant perturbation. And it was not considered in the original formula, in the original RG for fermions, because this interaction corresponds to a completely non-local interaction in real space. And the only interactions which were considered in the original argument of the relevance, irrelevance of repulsions, remember, they're short range. They did not look like this. Okay, so that term is relevant, can easily be illustrated here. L is now the perpendicular direction. So this term has dimension, this interaction has dimension -2, which means it's hugely relevant. This term, if you were to look at just the more general way of thinking about this, these kinds of interactions, these are density-density interactions. If you had just two momenta rather than one, this would have scaling dimension -1. Either this or this is relevant. So if they're relevant and you add them to the Fermi liquid part, which has scaling dimension 0, these operators are relevant and you have no guarantee that you're going to end up with a Fermi liquid. So that's how that's how these models got around the original scaling for these RG4 fermions. And what you end up with is a Mott insulator. Okay, so the general HK model is one that looks like this. This is not the Stoner model because the Stoner model has an average value around one of these terms. So it's a mean field model. This is not a mean field model, although it's highly solvable. And the key thing is that this and this commute. If they commute, you can write down the green function exactly. Here's the green function. And so even when Laughlin in 97 was saying there is no model that gives you a Mott transition, there is. There's this one. And the lower and upper Hubbard bands are well-defined. This is the lower band. This is the upper band. And note, these weights are not C numbers. They depend on the occupancies. And hence the number of high energy degrees of freedom is dependent on the number of low energy degrees of freedom. Another key point of Mottness. So now that you have these upper and lower bands, it makes sense to define the momentum space analog of the Hubbard operators. Because now the problem is completely diagonal in these operators. So I add and subtract this term, which is just this piece right here. I see that in fact, I have two operators. This tells you about K states, which are empty. This tells you about K states, which are singly occupied. There should be a dagger here, by the way. Okay. And there should be a dagger here. At least I think that's how we define these operators, but it doesn't matter. Both of them should be daggered. Okay, so if you work at half filling, this quantity looks like the green function looks like this. And no, it doesn't just have a simple pole. It's this quantity plus this. And because it has this quantity, you can end up with non-trivial physics. This quantity you can regard as the self-energy, although strictly speaking, it's not the self-energy because this self-energies are obtained perturbatively. This quantity diverges anytime this is true, both the real and the imaginary parts, and hence this is not obtainable by expanding around the non-interacting limit. If this quantity can equal infinity, the whole green function can vanish. This is how you get zeros. There's some non-trivial quantity which comes in here which destroys the particle concept. And hence, you don't have any quasi particles of the Fermi liquid type anywhere. Okay, so that's why this model is important. You have commutativity of the kinetic and the potential energy terms, but you still have a non-trivial green function. That you have a gap in the system can be seen by just plotting what the spectral function looks like. So here is the spectral function at half filling. We have spectral weight down here defining the lower band, and this is the upper band. And the zero line, the Luttinger surface, lies exactly in between. Because if you have the same spectral weight here and here, the zero surface has to lie at the particle hole symmetric point. And the chemical potential is here. Only this band is occupied. This one is empty. But this one doesn't carry all the spectral weight, as in a Fermi liquid. Okay. Now, as you dope the system, sorry, as you now change to U to be U less than W, this band can drop below the chemical potential. There will still be a range of states which are singly occupied, and only in the singly occupied region will you get the Luttinger surface. So the Luttinger surface is the thing that comes about because of the singly occupied region. And the singly occupied region is coming about entirely because you have U. Okay, so in this state, you have three different kinds of occupancies. You have states which are empty, singly occupied, and this part right below the chemical potential, this range of K states are doubly occupied. This part is occupied as well as this part down here. Okay, so this, and if you were to now dope the system, you could write down the wave function exactly for the metal. It's hugely degenerate. And that's why the Hatsugai-Komoto model is both problematic and important. It's important because Mott couldn't care less about what the spins were doing. He's interested in a charge gap. And so the Hubbard model conflates both the mechanism for the gap and the spin sector. And hence it might be confusing and it has led to lots of debates. Such a problem is not in the Hatsugai-Komoto model. It's a hugely degenerate part for the spin sector, the part that's singly occupied. You have to sum over all possible spin configurations that preserve this SU2 invariance. And so now the singly occupied part is here. This is now the Luttinger surface. And you can calculate exactly where you have sign changes. And over almost everywhere in the phase diagram, and this is the exact result, the occupancy is not one. Hence, we have an exactly solvable non-Fermi liquid. We know everything about it. We know all the excitations. And hence, we can ask further questions about this. For example, superconductivity. Okay, now, one of the questions that comes up. Okay, so let's just review. If you start with a Fermi gas, what do you do to it to get this Mott thing? Well, you have to have three different occupancies. So it's this sort of wedding cake in K space that you have. So now we can complete our picture. Fermi gas evolution, Fermi liquid, BCS, and the terminus of this is Sir Neville Mott. I'm sure he never thought he would be the terminus of this evolutionary process, but he is. And it's the 0, 1, and 2 that make the Hatsugai-Komoto model non-trivial in giving rise to the Mott state. Okay, now one of the questions that comes up is, okay, you have this Hatsugai-Komoto model, very solvable. What's the relationship to the Hubbard model? So here's a calculation on an 8-site cluster, just going and doing exact diagonalization, comparing Hatsugai-Komoto. So this is the spectral function for Hatsugai-Komoto. This is the spectral function for the Hubbard model with U of 12. Both of them have gaps. This is exact diagonalization, so there's no approximation here. And they don't look so different. In fact, this Hubbard term, as I will show you close to the end of the talk, is roughly irrelevant. Most of the gap is coming from the HK term. And if you were to dope the system, the thing that you see happening is dynamical spectral wave transfer. You see that this peak right here goes down, and this weight is now transferred here. There is more spectral weight right here. That is dynamical spectral wave transfer. That is not present in this model, and that's because the Hubbard operators in K-space diagonalize this problem. They do, the ones in real space do not diagonalize the Hubbard model. As a result, there's mixing. Okay, so this spectral function is scanning over the whole range in energy. I can plot this somewhat differently. So here's another exact diagonalization comparing Hubbard with HK. And the slice this way is exactly the spectral function. So these are the different sectors having different numbers of double occupancies. If Hubbard and HK were the same, there would be no dispersion here. So this is the myriad of states, and we've selected out the states that have arbitrary momentum, but are in the spin equals zero sector. Okay, so here is what is missing if you want to just do HK and not Hubbard. Now, as I said, the HK model leaves out dynamical spectral wave transfer. And what that means operationally is the following. If I start with one empty site in the Hubbard model, I let this evolve, I can end up with three empty sites by going and having double occupancy. Those sectors aren't mixed in the HK model. And this is coming about because the interaction term in Hubbard and the kinetic term do not commute, whereas they do in the HK model. So what the HK model does is it separates out the physics having to do with the gap from this problematic dynamics, because all of this stuff is already a T over U correction. Okay, and if you just look at this, the evolution of the states, all of those states in the middle there are really T over U corrections. Okay, so now that we have an exactly solvable model, we can ask the question about superconductivity. Shandon Seti wrote a paper on about insulating Luttinger surfaces and added pair fluctuations, and he found this fascinating connection with SYK. A question one can ask is, can you go and do something exact to see if any relationship like this is true? So what I want to do is demonstrate the Cooper instability for the HK model, which is a prototypical Mott insulator exactly of the kind Mott had in mind. So we just add this term. We write down the wave function, summing over the unoccupied part. We're creating pairs on this ground state of this HK model. And we're summing over the region which this thing is equal to zero. And the quantity you're calculating is this. And if there's binding, it had better be negative. You want this quantity to be negative. Now, what's very nice about the HK model is you can do this calculation exactly. Here's the answer. And you're summing over the region in which these things are zero. So there's only one integral to do. It's a very simple integral. And you're asking the question, are there negative solutions to this? Okay, well, there are, or I wouldn't be giving this talk. Here are the solutions. Okay, here's the binding energy as a function of the interaction. And this is obtained in the limit in which U is smaller than W. So I cannot set W going to zero. Okay, so that's a Cooper instability. Now, what we would like to do is demonstrate more than the Cooper instability. We'd like to show that in fact, there's a superconducting ground state. To do that, we need to go and evaluate the pair susceptibility. The pair susceptibility, you have to go and calculate this quantity. For this model, because it's so solvable, this reduces exactly to this, in which chi zero is just this quantity with g equals zero. And you can go and calculate chi zero exactly in this model, where this quantity equals zero determines Tc. So you have to solve for g chi zero equals one. And you can get out Tc. And here you go. Here's Tc, the rough form of Tc. W again, bigger than U, is this form. So this is the part that I feel as though anyone in solid state physics should have been able to do, certainly 1992, because we didn't use any method that is that wasn't known back then. It's just that you'd have had to have a reason why you wanted to go and do this in the first place. So you'd have had to understand Martinus and zeros and all of that, which was not understood in 1992. Okay, now, what makes BCS an incredibly powerful solution is they wrote down a wave function, and from that, they were able to go and do any calculation you wanted to tease out all of the properties of the superconducting state. Now, their wave function wasn't just valid for the superconducting state, it also describes the metallic or the norm, the Fermi liquid state, the normal state. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is just rewrite this wave function by only taking a product over the part of the spectrum in which K is positive. So I can rewrite this exactly like this. Now, why am I doing this? Because this is telling you something. This is the contribution which will only pick out things that have occupancy zero. This is telling you the part that's doubly occupied, and this is telling you the singly occupied part. I need all three to describe a normal state that looks like the HK metallic state. Okay, I'm trying to describe this, which means just to describe this, I need to have three variational parameters. Which means if I'm going to attempt to write down a wave function for the superconducting state in HK, I have to start with something that looks like this. This term will describe the empty part, this doubly occupied, and this singly occupied. And with that, we can ask the question, can we inform what the superconducting state looks like? And the answer is yes. We have three variational parameters. We can play the same game BCS did. We can take the expectation value of the energy and the thing that simplifies the expectation value for the Hamiltonian is the gap. And this quantity is written like this in the regime W is bigger than U. And we can now compare this with TC. And we can look at the gap to TC ratio. Remember in BCS, 2 delta over KTC is 3.5. In this case, because these exponents are different, this ratio is infinity. Now, what I mean by that is the following. In the limit that G goes to zero, you have different exponents here. You're going to end up with, this number is bigger than that one, you'll get something blowing up. Which means this ratio, because it's infinity, the superconductivity we have in this model is non-BCS-like. Okay. Now, the excited states are another key thing in characterizing the ground state of a BCS superconductor. And you can formulate what these operators are by, since there are none of these in the ground at t equals zero, this quantity right here should annihilate the BCS wave function. And for the BCS wave function, the things which give that annihilate it are linear combinations of particles and holes with these coherence factors, and this is the spin. So, what are the operators in our case? They are not these things. Remember, our superconductor is in a MOTS, is made out of a doped MOT insulator, which the electrons play no role. We call these new excitations pions, after how our names appeared in the paper Phillips, Yeo, and Huang. And here they are. We have excitations on the lower and the upper band. They're in terms now of the the composite Hubbert operators in K-space. It doesn't make any sense to describe anything like this for the Hubbert model, since those operators have nothing to do with diagonalizing the problem. Here they do. And hence they form the natural way of thinking about what the excited states of the superconducting state look like. Okay, so we have our excited states. We should be able to calculate everything. And we can. Everything BCS can calculate, we can calculate. And it's for superconductivity in a Dopemont insulator. I want to show you three such calculations. Okay, so these things definitely annihilate the superconducting state. You can take this expectation value. The energy which comes out is definitely gapped, and hence delta really does serve the purpose of the gap. And okay. So we know we have the right things. Now, if you have gaps both on the upper and the lower band, we should be able to see that if we were to just calculate the spectral function in the superconducting state. So this is what it looks like in BCS. You have a band dispersion. This is just a cosine K band. There's a gap right here. That's the superconducting band. These things that are, this is now the quasi-particle band that's coming about. And there's some backbending as a result of that. But in this case, it looks completely different. In this case, this is what happens. We have this physics going on in the upper and the lower band, which means superconductivity is affecting the high energy sector as well as the low energy sector. And that has to be the case because these operators which create these quasi-particle excitations are in both bands. So this is Mottness in the superconducting state. And that is what is fundamentally different about forming a superconductor out of a Dopemont insulator rather than a Fermi liquid. You don't just have to worry about what's going on in this sector. Everything is affected because every state here has spectral weight up here. And hence, if this is gapped, this also has to be gapped. Now, if we have something going on both at high energy and low energy, we should be able to explain something which has always puzzled me, and that is this superconductivity-induced transfer of in-plane spectral weight. And everyone knows this, but no one can explain it. So it's this, you simply count the number of charges by integrating the optical conductivity up to a point. And here it is and this is the high energy part, this is the low energy part. What you see on the system going into the superconducting state, there's a transfer of spectral weight from the high energy part to the low energy part, which does not occur in a Fermi, in a superconducting state formed from a Fermi liquid. So the observation is this, it doesn't continue there, it dips down here. And this dip down here is associated with not continuing here, but an acceleration in the weight in the lower part. So this trade-off between low and high energies is the defining feature of Mott physics, because each state lives at both energy scales. And I've always wanted to be able to explain this, and now we can. So what we did, before I tell you that, this change, just look at these numbers here, is not a big number. It's roughly 3%. So why worry about a 3% change in the spectral weight? We should worry about this because the experimentalists noted that this measured weight transfer is large enough to account for the condensation energy in these compounds. So if it's large enough to account for the condensation energy, then we should worry about it, because it's telling us something about the nature of the superconducting state. Not necessarily, I mean, it's more than the nature, the inherent excitations which are giving rise to the superconducting state. In my terminology, this is telling you about UVIR mixing. So what we did is we computed this quantity, the spectral weight in as a function of g over the spectral weight when this thing is zero. So hence we are comparing then the total weight as a result of superconductivity in the absence of superconductivity. And the key thing is that this quantity starts off at one. It's all bigger than one. And we computed this for various values of u. And this quantity being bigger than one says we're on the right track. And notice for reasonable values over here, it's between 2 to 3%, as in the experiments. Now, we don't know exactly what value of g, but you know, you say you need something bigger than one, let's say. So there you go. It's for reasonable values, you get something which is roughly on the order of what you see experimentally. You don't need g of 2000. It's just, you know, not a big number. Now, this is decreasing as you increase u. Any physics you see that's decreasing as you increase u is telling you about mixing with the upper band. In the presence of this term, the model now has two non-commuting parts. Anytime you have a non-commuting part, it's telling you that the physics is no longer pure HK physics, in which you don't have a mixing between the different K states. Okay, that's now happening. And as a result, this is dynamical spectral weight transfer. So the mechanism that we have settled on for what is going on is dynamical spectral weight transfer for this superconductivity-induced transfer, superconductivity-induced transfer of in-plane spectral weight. Okay, it's at this point that we sent the paper off to Nature Physics, and the reviewer said, great, but can you compute one more quantity? And they said, we should be able to compute the superfluid density. Okay, so this is the general mechanism. We ask the question, is this general mechanism? And we think it is, okay? So we can compute the superfluid density because we have all the ingredients. We have the wave function, we can easily do this. Okay, so this is what it looks like in a BCS superconductor. It has to be zero at these two ends because this is no filling. This is completely filled band insulator. It has to peak around one. Now the Mott problem has to vanish at this point, which means the superfluid density consists of two different domes. And so there's a suppression. So if you look at right here, which is, you know, roughly in the range of where you have the cuprates, relative to this point, there's a huge suppression of the spectral weight, and it's over a factor of two, so it's non-trivial. This is coming about because of the superconductivity being in the vicinity of the Mott insulator. So this is Mottness induced suppression of the superfluid density. Okay, so let me just summarize. If you start with a general four momentum interaction that generates local interactions in real space, you have to scale your operators in this way to get irrelevance of this quantity. So your theory is natural. The kinetic energy term has scaling dimension zero. And the only thing which can destroy any of this is the BCS instability. Now, if you were to add a term that looks like this, this you would find has scaling dimension minus two, which means you should probably scale towards this point. So if you scale towards this point, you find that the fermion, your fermions now have scaling dimension zero. And this interaction is now irrelevant. So which means that even if you have both of these, the fact that this thing has scaling dimension three is telling you this is going to be the flow in the system. So we're arguing that Mott physics is really governed by a new fixed point, and the HK model is just one of the myriad of models which is picking out the physics which is most relevant in destroying a Fermi liquid. And such interactions commute with this. They still give you a gap because it's disentangled Mott physics from the dynamical spectral wave transfer. And this is non-BCS superconductivity. The spectral weight is bigger than, this ratio is bigger than one. And here are the new excitations. These are pions, and they describe how Mott physics affects the superconducting state. I think that's all I have to say.
Good. Thanks a lot, physics. Sorry. Thanks a lot, Philip, for the very nice talk. So let's start from any questions from the audience.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
So I'm curious, the numerics that you showed, or like some of the data sort of at the end, or like, you know, superfluid density or whatever, the experimental kind of quantities, it seems like they're computed from the one-dimensional HK model. Is that, or like, how does this look if you're in?
No, this is any number of dimensions. This is the two-dimensional model.
The model like I see is exactly solvable, so it should be. But like the numerical result seems like they would depend on the dimensions. Is that not true?
Some of the details depend. No, let me just clarify something here.
Yeah.
Okay. If you look at the HK model, there is no restriction on.
Philip, I think you need to restore the screen again.
Yeah. I'm restoring it. I'm restoring it. Yeah, okay. There's no restriction. Remember, this term is written down on a hypercubic lattice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this is not independent of the dimensionality. I think do you understand what I'm saying? You are worrying about this term, which looks like it doesn't have any spatial dependence, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Once you have a hypercubic lattice, you just do this sum over all of just with this restriction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there is a structure in the system, and it's coming from this term.
Okay. I see.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So we just did the two-dimensional version of this to get our superfluid density.
Okay. I see.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I had a question about the relation between the HK plus pairing model with SYK. So is this non-BCS superconductor smoothly connected to the SYK, the Majorana SYK non-Fermi liquid, or are they completely different solvable models? Or
we have found no connection, mm-hmm. So we do not. Okay, if you are trying to understand superconductivity in a dope Mott insulator, in which you're perturbatively introducing the pairing interaction, there's no relationship with SYK. There might be if you turn on such a huge interaction and you're in the, remember, he studied an insulating Luttinger surface. So if you're in a gap system and you turn on an interaction, a pairing interaction that's comparable to the gap, yeah, you might be able to get something in the BC crossover, but we are not interested in that regime and we did not explore it because I don't think it's physical. Mm-hmm. So, right. I would say our work points to having nothing of any great deep connection between this model and SYK. Although, what's interesting is that this model was written down a year before SY.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Baskerville knows that as well. And so, you know, maybe there's some sociological reason, but I don't see any scientific connection between the two at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess your superconducting state, it's non-BCS, but it still has quasi-particle excitations, right?
It has quasi-particle excitations. They are not, but they're quasi-particle excitations made out of composite operators.
Right.
Okay, they're the composite operators that form these upper and lower Hubbard bands. Where are the upper and lower Hubbard bands? Okay. I'll get to them. Yeah, there you go. They're the things that form these bands.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not single electron operators.
Right.
Okay. So the key thing here is that the excitations that you get out of this know that the system came from a Mott insulator or dope Mott insulator.
Mm-hmm. And another question I had was, so at least regarding SYK, people have gotten some mileage from considering clusters of that model in an attempt to, you know, make some quasi-local version.
Yes, that's right.
Is there some similar like chains of these that would?
There's no reason to do that. You see, the reason why people did that mm-hmm. is they wanted this crazy non-local physics on one region to now hop to another region so you could get a kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
There's already a kinetic energy in this model. So there's no reason to want to go and do the analogous thing that is right. done in SYK. Go ahead.
What about relaxing the highly non-local interaction? Like, okay. Is there like a tunable, solvable model? I don't know.
Okay. So great. So in their first paper, this is what they considered. I have to let the plumber in.
Okay.
Just one second. Sorry about that, but that's the
no worries. Yeah.
The issue of having Zoom in your house. It's Zoom in your house. Right. So good. So in their second paper, what they considered is a model which looks like this. Mm-hmm. Okay. And okay. The question you really are asking is this. You don't want to relax the non-locality necessarily. What you want to do is relax the constraint that the thing happening, the interaction term and the kinetic term are commuting.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to now do a perturbation in all of the corrections that take you to the full non-commutativity between this and this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what that would do is take you to the Hubbard model.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. But my point is, that's not. If this term has scaling dimension minus one, and Hubbard has scaling dimension three, why would you go and? No. So what you can do is, so maybe the question you're asking is, are there a family of solvable models that I could write down that in which I just start adding on other terms here? Yeah, there are, okay? But I'm not sure that, I think what you need to do is think about this in the RG sense. You know, what is the relevance of these terms?
Any other questions? Well, if not, thanks again, Philip, for the interesting talk. Thanks for stopping by virtually.
Stopping by virtually.